Welcome to the Golden Age of Cardboard podcast, where we remember a time when stacks of cards were held together with rubber bands and Mickey Mantles were put in bike spokes. We hope you will enjoy and reminisce as you come along with us as we tell stories about the baseball cards from the Golden Age of Baseball. We will examine the state of the vintage baseball card market and talk to some of the greatest collectors in the hobby. You won't be hearing us talk about any chrome or shiny cards here. Now, to take you on this retrospective journey, here's your host, direct from the shallow end of the gene pool, my son, Mike Moynihan.
Yo and hello, everybody. Mike here. Welcome to another awesome episode of the Golden Age of Cardboard podcast. Whether you're watching on YouTube, listening on podcast, I appreciate you being here. Today's topic is pretty timely. Today, I'm going to bring on a guest and we're going to talk through an issue that I think both of us have had some serious thoughts about, some things that are changing in my life that have caused me to think about this a lot more. And it's one of my becoming a great friend in the hobby, and he's relatively new to YouTube, but has just blown up on YouTube. People love him. He does a lot of great storytelling, great videos, and he's got, you know, the same as me, a face for radio, and it's none other than Greg Midlife Cards. Hey, Greg.
Definitely have that face for radio, 100%. How's it going?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. Good Easter? It was a great Easter. Yeah, we did sunrise service. So we woke up at the crack, well, before the crack of dawn. And we've got a beautiful spot that overlooks the community that we live on a hill. And did that up there. It was terrific.
That is awesome. We had a massive turnout for church on Sunday, which was great. In our little, where we go to church out by the ranch. And that was great. And then dinner with family, you know, meals with family and ate too much and all that fun stuff happened throughout the rest of the day. But yeah, great Easter. Our topic today, I want to talk about the general idea will be, can you be a collector? Can you still call yourself a collector and sell cards? And I want to talk about some of my experiences. I want you to talk about some of your experiences because we might differ a little bit on this, and that'll be good banter for discussion, but where do you fall in that? If I just asked you that question, would you answer yes or no? And then why would you answer the way you would answer?
Well, so I would say, yes, you can be a collector and sell cards. I consider myself a collector and I sell cards. I don't sell a ton of cards, but I sell cards. It's hard though, when you are using yourself as the example, because you know, we probably see ourselves differently than others see us. So I think a good way to do it is to look at somebody else. And so when I think of somebody like who's a real collector, like one of the first people I think of is Orlando. I think Orlando is a true collector who loves it. He absolutely loves it. And he's sold a lot of stuff, even after he was dealing, he was selling stuff to pay for stuff that he wanted that he didn't have. And they were gold cards. And he said, I've had these. These were cool while I had them. But now this is what I want. So I'm going to move in this direction. And I don't think Orlando using his cards to buy other cards makes him any less of a collector. He's sort of like the poster child of a true collector to me. So yeah, that's kind of my take.
Yeah, Orlando, for those of you listening on podcast, he has on YouTube, his channel is called A Collector's Dream. It is unbelievable. His knowledge and just the way he talks about cards, he's romantic when he talks about cards. I feel like I need to turn the lights down and put on a little Barry White when he's talking about cards because it's awesome. So if you don't watch him, you should. I agree about Orlando. I think that's a great person. He's told me about his story, and he's been on the show. I've had Mike Summer on the show, who is Wax Pack Hero on podcast. He has a podcast and does a lot of different things in the hobby. And he basically runs a completely self-sustaining hobby. You know, he takes very little money out of his family budget, so to speak, and basically uses cards to buy other cards and trade and do things to get his collection where it is. And I used to, Greg, I'll admit, think that was made you less of a collector. I'll admit it. I'll own that I used to feel that way. And it's only because I have cards that I've had since 1981 in my closet over here. And I went so long without selling a card that I had. Now, from time to time, I would get dupes of stuff or whatever. And I'd be like, well, I don't need two of these, so I'll just sell one. Accidentally, you know, I bought a card twice or whatever. But even that made me a hypocrite to say that, because, and I know guys that don't sell anything, right? We both know collectors that do think it's blasphemous to sell cards ever. Like, if you're a true collector, you'll never sell a card. And again, I probably was in that camp for a long time, but I've had this recent transformation of thought, evolution of thought, maybe even, because we did a Chasing Cardboard episode where we went down to Houston, me and Ty, and met a dealer down there. He owns a shop and had used cards. He always had this philosophy: if I sell a card, half of the money goes towards family stuff, half of the money goes back into cards. And he happened to have a tremendous Pat Mahomes collection that he sold a bunch of it, took half of that money and adopted a kid, and then bought a farm and started his store all with card money. Mm-hmm. You know, he hit on Mahomes and he went in huge on Jalen Hurts and sold, you know, hey, I'll sell Jalen Hurts if the money's right, you know, and did really well with that. And that got me, that was kind of this great thought of, okay, you can do both and you can help your family. I mean, I've worked so hard to accumulate all these cards over the last 40 plus years. To what end? Right. I also turned 50. Like, there's all these things that have happened that have been little nudges in a direction of, maybe I'm not thinking about this right. Maybe I need to think differently about this. And so, you know, hearing that guy in Houston and me turning 50, and Julie keeps my wife, both of our wives are very tolerant, right? And understanding, yeah. And absolute angels, and awesome that they let us even participate in this hobby the way we do. But at the same time, Julie's like, you know, what later? Where's the end? And I always pushed her away and didn't, you know, she's been asking that question for a decade. It's not like that's a new question. I've just always ignored it. And for some reason, the last few times it's, I've been thinking longer about that. You know, I hope to live 25, 30 more years. That'd be great. But I don't know, you know, all our days are numbered. We just don't know the number. And so what then? And so I'll get to more of my story in a minute. I want to ask you, Greg, when you said you've sold a few cards, what makes a card for you, okay, I'm willing to sell this?
A card becomes, I'm willing to, that's a good question. Well, a lot of the reason that there are cards that I don't ever want to get rid of is because of the story that goes with the card. And so depending on how I acquired a card would affect my willingness to sell the card. I have some cards that are worth $2 that I absolutely wouldn't sell. So sometimes when you buy like a bulk, like you buy maybe like four cards in one deal, those cards are kind of less special to me than one card that you were hunting for and looking for it, and then you ended up finding it. And so the story of how you found it and how you acquired it makes it more or less special. But also, you know, for me, my interests are always changing. And because I'm kind of going down this road that is always has something different around each turn, you know, and I'm more open to selling something to get something that I now want more, especially if it's something like I hear you say all the time, like the cards that I'm looking for, they're not rare cards. You say that all the time. Like you say, you know, if this guy's not going to go below sticker, then I'll go to someone else who will go below sticker and I'll get a good deal on it because it's not a rare card. If it is a rare card, I'm a lot more hesitant to let it go because I might not get it again. But like some of the cards I've sold recently, like I sold a beautiful 63 Topps Willie Mays, which is so hard to find centered. And it was really well centered. And I sold that. And I sold a really nice 64 Sandy Koufax, like a pretty high grade. And it was like, if I want those cards, I can go get that card. It's not like I won't be able to find that card. Like I could go on eBay probably and find those cards right now. But cards that I'm trying to get at, that I'm hunting for, are some of those cards that it may take a while to get it again, or you know, or at least in the grade I can afford to find one that I like the looks of. So the rarity of the card certainly plays a factor, because I know I could reacquire it if I feel like I blew it and it doesn't have a story attached to it that would pain me to get rid of it.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate the emotional attachment that we might have to certain cards, right? And how can you put a dollar value on that? And that's part of it, as you're saying, you know, the cards you weren't emotionally attached to, like, yeah, I can get those whenever I want if I decide I want it again or whatever, makes sense. I do think it's important to lay out the reality. I'm going to try to do this without sounding like a complete jackwagon, which good luck to me for that. But a lot of it depends on a person's financial situation, right? Mm-hmm. There are certain people that I know, that you know, that seemingly have unlimited card budgets and they just kind of buy whatever they want and they don't sell stuff because they don't need to. And truthfully, I've been in that category for a while where if I needed to, I'd sell a card in a heartbeat if my family needed the money. I've been blessed. I've got enough income where I buy cards with discretionary income. I'm not using credit cards or bill money or anything like that. And that just happens to be a larger amount than, you know, certain people. Well, I don't begrudge myself for that, or I don't feel guilty about it. It's just, this is the hand I was dealt. And so I haven't been forced to sell cards. And I haven't started selling cards because I have to. I had some people say in a video that I did over on Baseball Collector, where I've talked about this extensively in terms of the cards that I'm selling currently, is, well, is it, you know, it's finally come to roost. You know, all you big influencers, you just spend. And it, finally, it's come back to bite you in the butt, basically, is what the guy was saying. And I'm like, that's not the case at all. It's kind of the... Where I got to was on this stuff I'm selling right now, which is a giant box of Hall of Fame autograph and relic cards. And the Hall of Fame is certainly my milieu of choice, right? I'm baseball Hall of Famers and getting all the slabs of the Topps cards and, you know, having autographs of every Hall of Famer. And I had a point where I wanted relics of every Hall of Famer. And I started looking at this box and I'm going, this is a giant box, five row, you know, box of extras, of all doubles, all stuff that I had multiples of, 20 plus, 50 plus of different Hall of Famer autographs, you know. And I'm like, what do I need all this for? And Julie's big thing was, those are very hard to get rid of unless you know what you're doing. It's going to take a lot of time. You got to know what you're doing. Slabs are like currency. They're very easy to dispense and easy to figure out the value, easy to figure out things. Just random Brooks Robinson autograph, maybe a little bit harder to move in terms of figuring out value and pricing it right so that you can sell it and yada, yada, right? So that's what this box was just these non-slabbed, non-playing days. Like I kept everything that mattered to me. I kept everything that was that I considered to be a project. This was in a box entirely made up of cards that over time through eBay shows, wherever I would just pick up, I'd see Brooks Robinson on, I'm gonna keep using Brooks Robinson, but Brooks Robinson autograph for $20. I'm like, sure, I'll pay $20 for that, you know, or whatever. And time after time after time, year after year after year after year, I accumulated so much excess that it became unnecessary. And I'm like, what is the point of all this? And then I said, well, I'm going to use the guy in Houston, the dealer in Houston's theory. I'm going to sell some of this. Julie and I are trying to do some things at the ranch. And it's not that I couldn't do all of it. It's not that I couldn't financially afford to do the things at the ranch and keep all my cards. It was, how cool would it be to take these cards and be able to say, I sold cards and was able to do these things at the ranch? How cool would it be to also take half that money and buy a card that would be a financial stretch for me, you know, that I couldn't afford, you know, I'd have to save up for it. I'd have to really think about it. I'd have to sacrifice something else in my life to acquire. And I'm like, I got all the assets in the world I need right here to make all that happen. Mm-hmm. You know, why wouldn't I give that a shot? And so I've been doing that with a lot of joy, quite frankly. It's obviously a lot of work, but making money is work. Like, welcome to the real world. It's been some work. It hasn't been like burdensome and overly crazy or anything, but I've enjoyed it. I'm enjoying seeing, I'm getting a lot of responses now. People are getting their cards that they bought from me and they're thrilled to death. And I love that. I'm getting to pass that on to the next, because I can't remember who said it. Somebody has said this line, and I'm going to forget who, so I'm not even going to guess. You may remember who said this multiple times, but we're only stewards of these cards for a temporary period. At some point, they're going to be owned by someone else, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And no matter how long I live, if I own them for another 30 years, at some point, 30 years and one day from now, someone else is going to own that card, because Julie's not going to keep them. My kids don't care about them. And so, you know, it's like I've enjoyed having them. Like you said, you've enjoyed it. Orlando's philosophy, right? Which is he enjoyed having them. He loved having them. And, you know, I've turned a box of stuff that's just excess into $7,000 in a few weeks. You know, that's good. That's really good money. Mm-hmm. Of which $3,500 I gave to Julie. I went and cashed a check for her just to give her $100 bills, because I thought it'd be funny. Or just she'd get the... It's different cash and just, hey, I transferred money into your account or something.
Right.
There's a much more emotional response, tactile response to that. And so I went and cashed a check for the half of that's hers, you know, in air quotes. Right. And she's like, oh my gosh, go sell more was what she, you know, the instant, go do more of that, you know?
Yeah.
And so she was tickled about that. I was happy. I've got money now going towards some bigger cards that I have my eyes on. Some Lou Gehrig, the long Lou Gehrig is number one on that list. 34 Gaudi Lou Gehrig. So it's been an interesting experience.
Which 34 Gaudi Lou Gehrig?
I need the yellow. I have the green.
Got it.
And what's funny is none of this is detracting from my desire to collect. It's not taking away from that, which I thought it would. I thought me selling cards would be kind of like me selling out, and like I would lose part of my collector mentality. I'd always be thinking about money and yada, yada. And that just couldn't be further from the truth. I'm actually more excited about what I'm going to be able to get now that was really on the back burner before because of the financial constraints. Now I'm excited because now it seems more real. Now it seems more possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things you said in there especially hit home is I think there are a lot of people who love cards and they don't have the discretionary income, at least not at the moment, to be able to acquire some of the cards that they want. And so if you're, you know, researching cards and learning about cards and reading about cards and watching videos about cards and experiencing cards, you start to acquire all of this knowledge, and that knowledge has value. And so I think that it's wonderful that somebody could literally learn about something to the point that they could make some money from it. And by making some money from it, be able to contribute that to make their collection possible. Because you know, when you go to, when you see these videos of these young guys that are, you know, buying, you know, Brock Purdy cards for $9,000 and selling it for $10,000, that's not, they're not really dealing with cards. Cards is just the currency that they're flipping, and they're day trading basically. But the person who loves 1965 Topps cards and it knows that set inside and out and learns about that set and is able to use that knowledge to make some smart buys and make some money to afford some of the cards that they want, is now that's phenomenal, because that's, I think, of anything, if you can make something out of nothing through what you enjoy, I that to me is a collection that I almost respect. Well, I do respect more than the guy who's just got deeper pockets and can go out and buy it all. Now, more power to that guy that could buy a bunch of stuff. Like, that's great. And if I had more money, I would buy more stuff too. But to be able to just grind it out and make something out of nothing is really cool.
Yeah. You just said something there that is so critical in how I've transformed my thought, and that's the making something out of nothing. And where I'll go with that is recent experience, literally recent, like this is an ongoing thing that's happening right now. But because I've had opportunities to buy some collections, right? And when you buy a collection, when I buy a collection, there's always going to be stuff in there that I need. There's going to be some stuff I need or want, and some stuff that I already have, right? And I don't need two of it. I'm not one of those guys that needs, you know, 18, you know, Carl Yastrzemski rookies. One is fine. I actually have two, right, of those, but that's a different reason. There's emotional attachment to that one. But I use that as, that was a bad example. Any other card, like I don't need dupes, right? I need, one is good. Mm-hmm. And so seeing these collections and buying these collections and being a part of Chasing Cardboard and seeing all this, it's like, wow, there's a lot of cards out there that are still ready to be had. I went down to Houston and did saw a collection with a gentleman, picked up a lot of stuff that I wanted from my collection. He wanted some advice on how to go about selling his massive collection. It was a huge collection, the biggest I've ever seen in terms of value. It was crazy. But then last week, I'm going to leave all the names out and places out because this is still an ongoing saga, and I really want to be careful not to divulge too much. But I got a call from a friend in the hobby who said, basically, you got to FaceTime me right now. And he was at his local card shop, and a bunch of cards have walked in the door, which is what happens when you own a card shop. From time to time, people walk in the door with cards. This was an older gentleman that said, this is my dad. My dad and I's collection. And he was an elderly gentleman already. So I'm FaceTiming with my friend, and it's all the 33 Gaudi Gehrigs, all the 33 Gaudi Roos, an entire 33 Gaudi set on top of that. Two DeLong Gehrigs, which is kind of my grail card, right? So that was a big thing that piqued my friend's interest. He knew that's kind of a card I'm really hunting and wanting to get, along with the rest of the DeLong set from 1933. Wow. It kept going, man, like a 39 play ball DiMaggio, a 39 play ball Ted Williams. And I'm getting picture after picture after picture from my friend going, holy crap, you know? And so I immediately start thinking, because what I understand about the dealer is his knowledge of vintage is very limited. He's a modern guy, loves opening new product. He's that kind of guy and doesn't have an extensive knowledge about vintage, which is why he called my friend in the first place to come say, what am I looking at here? What is all this? You know, basically. And so visions of me being able to acquire this collection, personal, you know, buy it in partnership with my friend. We would do it, go into this deal together, and the idea was make something out of nothing. Get a lot of cards, huge grail cards that would take me a decade to acquire over time with my own money, or I could buy this whole collection, pull some cards out, sell all the rest that I don't need, want, care about, and not only make all my money back, but get basically these cards for free. That was what was going through my mind. He and I talked, you know, all through the Easter weekend, multiple times a day. Okay, where are we at? What's he wanting to do? What's this owner of the cards? What's he wanting to do? And it was a big deal. Like, we're talking 6-figure deal. Okay.
Wow.
And the card shop owner eventually did the deal with the guy and bought all the cards for way less than 6 figures, way, way less than 6 figures. And I felt like that, I think it was a combination of he valued the collection way lower than I did based on what I saw, what research I did. I priced a lot of things. I did a whole lot of homework, had a lot of fun doing it, ironically. What's this? And I assumed all of the, because everything was raw, right? So non-graded. So I assumed everything as an SGC2. Because we would grade a significant, we're talking $10,000+ of just grading fees to do this. And everything all the way through the 70 sets, multiple, you know, Rose rookies, and he had football too, Namath rookies. He had two Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Lew Alcindor rookies, you know, from 69 to 70. Like, it was just this massive horde of awesomeness, right? And here we are, you know, the next week, sitting here now, the deal's been done, the cards have been acquired by the card shop owner, and now I don't know what's next. I've made an offer to the card shop owner to give him a significant profit on his investment and get all the cards and be, you know, like, okay, now they're mine. I'll make you a lot of money and I'll be happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll have everything and try to do it now versus the original thought of dealing that the card shop owner was going to basically swing and miss and not have the opportunity to get them. Because of cash, you know, just coming up with the right amount of money that the card owner would take. The card owner ended up taking a significantly smaller amount of money than I was willing to offer in cash, but I never talked to the card owner. I was always the third party, right? I'm many, many states away from where, and I was ready to get on a plane, like literally the next day, and go up there and check all this stuff out. Cause obviously I'm not going to buy it all sight unseen.
Yeah.
But I was ready to make this happen because I saw the value in the entire collection, which would help me to bring this circle all the way back around, is acquire a bunch of cards with essentially no money out of my pocket because I would get all the money back from all the stuff that I don't need, want, or care about.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've missed this opportunity. It's still an ongoing, we're still working with the card shop owner to hopefully acquire the collection. And then it's literally fly to SGC. Like, these are big enough cards, the Ruths and all that. We'd fly to SGC and
drop them off,
you know, fly to PSA on the ones we want a PSA grade and drop them off, you know? And it's one of those, the story makes sense. The provenance makes sense. Everything I saw about the Gaudis, look, there's bleed through, all the things you want to see that tell you real, not real. And, you know, a guy's not going to have a whole DeLong set if they're all fake. He's only going to have the Gehrig, you know, or the whatever. You know, he wouldn't have everything that he had if you're not just going to fake all the other commons and all the other stuff that he had. Wouldn't make sense. So that's my story, Greg.
First of all, that's an amazing story, and I can't wait to see how it all unfolds. It sounds like you're very excited as well to hear how it unfolds. But just the mentality of your willingness, if you are a person who thought it was sacrilegious to sell carts, then the thought of being able to do this deal where you could basically take part of the collection to keep and sell the other stuff is almost off the table if you're unwilling to sell. So the evolution of where you're at in your collecting, where you're open to that concept, puts things on the table that otherwise probably wouldn't be. I mean, Chris Sewell just did a video, I want to say last weekend, and it was a big deal. And he just had a couple of pictures, but he told a great story. And it was exactly the same thing. It was, they sold off the collection to get their money back, and they each ended up with some really cool cards. And some of them Chris still has, and some of them he sold off. Yeah. And it was like, that's a great way to do it.
Yeah, it is. And again, like you said, in a previous mindset, I would have been apt to, I guess I'm going to have a whole 33 Gaudi set now. How cool is that? You know, and I'm going, I don't need a 33. Like, that's not something that I get the people that want to have a 30. Great, I'll sell it to them. That's not something that gets what I want, some of the key Hall of Famers out of it. And, you know, oh, the 34 Gaudi, he had both Gehrigs. He had the Greenberg rookie. He had, you know, he had all these cards that are on
in those two sets. There's the Hack Wilson, there's the Mel Ott's, there's the Carl Hubbles. I mean, there are some just, and these are a tier below the Gehrigs and the Roos, but they're still massive really cards.
Yeah. And he had all of them, you know, some of them duplicates, some of them, you know, he had a whole 39 play ball set. He had a whole 40 play ball set. He had, you know, it was just, I'm telling you, it just kept coming and coming, and my mental value of what was there. Again, I still haven't seen any of this, but.
So one of the things I struggle with, and I don't want to take us down too far of a direction, but I think it's an important question to ask you, is how hard is it for you to be patient? Because one of the most difficult parts of collecting, I think, for a lot of us, is we just go, I want to buy this. I want it. I want it now. I want to buy it now. That's the only one available. So I'm going to buy that one, even if it's not the right one. And sometimes we just have to sit and wait. And that's very, very difficult for us. And in your situation right now, like, honestly, with as much as you have at stake, based on what you're saying, I'd have a hard time not flying out and just going and sitting down with the not knowing the owner of the shop, like sitting down and going, what's the number it's going to take? Just tell me, okay, just shoot me a number. And then at least I'll know where you're at. Like, I would have a hard time just waiting.
So totally ironic that you say that. I'm trying to figure out how quick I can get up there and do exactly that and just go see everything. Whether I get a deal done or not, it's worth the expense to me to have that opportunity, to try to grasp that opportunity and seize it. So in your patient, with your patience question, typically I'm very patient. And in fact, I say all the time, it's a marathon, not a sprint. Collecting is a marathon, not a sprint. None of this is rare. None of this is right. We've reiterated a lot of these points, all of which tie together and tell a good story of, hey, if you can't get it today or you can't afford it today, it'll still be there down the road. And barring another pandemic, you might even be able to get it cheaper than you would today. So patience might serve you well. Mm-hmm. We all have stories of regrets of cards we wish we would have bought because they were a lot cheaper back in the day and all of that. I don't kick myself over that because I wasn't in a position to do it. So it's not even worth, you know, crying over spilled milk. I couldn't do it, so I didn't, and now I can, or whatever, right? But with this, you're right. It's a unique situation where, honestly, Greg, I've had a hard time even sleeping. I think when I'm laying down in bed, I'm going, okay, what if I did this? What if I did that? I'm running through scenarios. The current thing on the table now is an offer to him. We've got an offer to him, and it might just mean me showing up and literally saying, hey, because once you see the money, it would be a big diff. You know, I think he might have, the same emotional response that my wife did is, okay, this guy's for real. You know, it's one thing to say it. Oh, I'd offer you this, and it's some crazy amount of money. And whatever, you know, that's a pipe dream. And no, I'm here at your shop with a backpack full of hundreds ready to do this deal.
And now let me ask you this too, because I think now I'm strategizing, trying to help you get the deal. So I think that what you could bring to the table for a card shop is more than just cash, and being able to present, hey, if we do this deal, I can also do this and this and this. You know, I could do an episode on this that's going to be seen by 40,000 people that like cards. I mean, like, there are things that it seems like would be hard to not leverage on a deal this extreme, which it would make for outstanding viewing, and it could really help him. I mean, you know, there, Dave Portnoy, when he does pizza reviews and he gives a good review, the pizza place is like overrun for a month. I mean, there's stuff like that, that there's something to that, but
probably hard to quantify that value. Right. But you know, I would obviously, and we do this on all of our shows. I'm not here to throw anybody under the bus. I'm not here to disparage anybody's character, or I want to promote them. And if the dealer was, the card shop owner was cooperative in letting a deal get done, and he does well too, by the way, it's not like he's getting off without making a tremendous amount of money in a very short period of time and dealing with something. I mean, it's like he's got to grade all these, and that's not a world he's in. Like, he has to learn all this, and that learning curve can be expensive and time consuming. All right, dude, you just want to run your shop. I'll give you some great promo. Like you said, like, that's great. And I think people would eat it up if they got to see this story unfold and see what happens with the, I mean, I'm telling you, man, these cards are just bananas. Oh, a red Cobb, T206 red Cobb.
Oh, geez.
T206 Cy Young, a T207 Walter Johnson. I mean, it's just,
oh,
bananas stuff. It's like, yep, that fits. Check, right? And here's the hard part. I'm going to have a hard time going, what do I sell? What do I keep? And because there'll be so much I want to keep. That's the key of selling cards that I'm learning, is you can't keep everything. As you acquire collections, whether it's on Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace, or, you know, your buddy down the street, you walk into the garage sale and he's got a bunch of cards. You got to learn, okay, what do I want to keep? What do I want to, you know, try to get some of my money back, recoup some of my initial investment, et cetera. Our goal would be to recoup all of the initial investment and still have cards left over for each of our collections, just like you said, Chris Sewell. And we're using the Chris Sewell Texas Snowman model, in the way we're thinking about this. And Chris Sewell has volunteered to go with me and look at this collection just for fun. So I've already talked to Chris about it. I've been talking to some people individually, trying to pick their brains, ask their opinion, have them give me insight. I've gotten some really good ideas from everybody. The idea of promoting, you know, doing some type of promotional help for the guy, that would be, that's a great idea. I hadn't thought of that yet, bringing that to the table. Mm-hmm. But showing up is definitely a possibility, where I literally just, all right, I'm coming, not knowing how this is going to turn out. Let's see if we can get a deal done.
Yeah, just to even look at them to know if you should or shouldn't be sleeping at night.
Right.
Right. I mean, you might get there and go, oh, I'm really never going to sleep until this gets done. Or, you know, or you might just go, oh, it's not quite what I thought it was. You know, right. I mean, it would at least give you more information.
Yeah.
So it would make him know you're serious, and it would give you more information. And you know, and the other part of it too is, as we're talking about selling cards and stuff, the opportunities and ways to sell are so much broader now than they were. Like, you know, I mean, with a collection like that, like, honestly, it's almost worth like getting a table at the National, you know, it's worth, because you would probably save more by just paying the high table fee at the National than, you know, trying to sell it and mail it and all the labor involved with that, just cash coming in and paying that one fee, and you could turn over a lot of it. I don't know. Like, that's,
well, we've certainly explored, all right, let's get a bunch of it. What the first thing is, what do we grade? What do we, you know, kind of, what do we put aside to keep? What do we grade, including the stuff we would keep? And then how do we sell it? Private deals, setting up at shows is obvious. I think shows have become so popular because it's such a great avenue to sell, because your costs are relatively fixed. And, you know, if you have good stuff, you're going to sell a bunch of it and make a good profit.
Well, and the record.
And it's all cash.
Lack of records. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all cash, right? Or most 99% cash for the most part.
Right.
So, you know, I happen to have a pretty big show that happens every 2 months near me, the Dallas
right.
show.
Right.
And setting up there would be awesome because there's so few, you know, really good vintage dealers there that we would stick out if we had a collection like this that we were moving a bunch of the cards. I've talked to dealer friends of mine that would be willing to potentially, obviously depending on condition and how much of it and whatever, but buy a bunch of the stuff because they help people build sets. And, you know, they're always looking for inventory of commons and things to add to their repertoire, to their inventory. So we've explored a lot of options, Greg, on, okay, if this happens, what's step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? And to A, how fast can we recoup the initial investment? That's always number one. And what this really turned into a different discussion, but I kind of knew it would if we started talking about
this is fantastic.
I think everybody should think about if you're going to sell cards, you know, not that you can't take an L. I think card owners, if you're selling cards, you need to be willing to say you were wrong, you know, about a player or timing or whatever, and just missed it. I'm sure I'm selling some of these cards. I have no idea what I paid for all of them, but all the autos and relics that I'm selling, I'm sure I'm selling some of them for under what I paid for them. Luckily, I don't know, so it doesn't make me, you know, kick myself about it. But the reality is they're selling for what they're selling for, and that is what it is. And you can either hold them and wait or sell them and get cash and move on to the next idea. And
yeah.
So I would tell people, take losses, know what your investment, know what you need to get back, know what you need to, you know, be made whole and all that kind of stuff, and then take your profit and be smart with it.
Yeah. I mean, and I also think, this goes back to where I was going before you told this story, which is using the knowledge that you've acquired from cards to, you know, make a few bucks from cards to pay for your cards, you know? And I think that, you know, where else would you not acquire knowledge and then get some sort of, you know, benefit to help you in that area of interest? Like,
right.
You know, I think that's just normal. I totally respect the people that don't want to sell stuff, but I do. And we both know, I mean, you and I would probably on the same hand, if we were to name five people, we'd probably name the same five people that we would think of with that. But, and I totally respect it and I totally get it, but I don't think it makes anybody less of a collector to do something like, you know, even the basement collection, you know,
yeah.
It's like, even with Dave, like you do this deal with Dave, it's good for Dave. Like Dave knows stuff. He could have sold it. He just is like, you know what? I don't want to deal with it. I want to do it with somebody that I trust. I want somebody that I like to benefit from it. So I'm going to do it through you. And then, you know, you piece things out and you had different people involved. And it's like, you know, that's just, you've put in so many hours logging information and there's this accumulation of knowledge that it's not wrong for people to be able to benefit from that, especially when it's not just dollars into your account that's going to sit there, but when it then becomes money that goes into the collection and it helps the progression of infusing money into the hobby for other people and other dealers and other sellers for other purchases.
Yeah. Yeah. And the basement collection is a great example. I mean, we did YouTube shows, whatnot, private deals, eBay. We pieced that out across many different platforms, to do it relatively quickly and as efficiently as we can, as we could. And that turned out to be a really good deal for everybody involved, right? I got a few cards for my collection. Dave got the money he wanted. I involved a couple of other friends that I basically consigned some cards with them. They made money. I made money. you know, it was, I got all my money back and then some, you know, it's, that was a, that's a great example. It does help that I have a great network of friends that I can rely right. on. Like you said, the, not just my cumulative knowledge, but now I'm leveraging that with other people that have expert, like there were football cards and other stuff that I don't know about. Well, I do know a guy that knows that and let him do that. You know, that kind of thing was very advantageous in that deal. And so, yeah, I'm glad I can leverage all this time I've spent in the hobby to maybe make this happen.
And I think it also goes back to another thing we talked about at the very beginning of the history of a card and the story of the card has a value to it. Like the thought of having a card from that basement collection. So we're talking about Dave Blue Jacket's dad's collection, basically. And you could have a card.
Carl Berg was his name. Yep.
So, okay. So you go from a card that Dave's dad had, which then became Dave's, which then went through Mike. And these are all people that, you know, or at least Dave and you people know. And it's like, I got this card from Mike through Dave, from Dave's dad. Like that makes that card more special. And people, that's a perfect example of a card that if I have a card like that, that same 63 Topps Maze, I would be way less likely to sell. Cause I'm like, no. That's from Dave's dad's collection. I can't get rid of that. That card is worth way more than the one I bought in bulk.
Right. Yeah. And we had people telling us exactly that. Hey, I don't care what I buy. I just want to buy something from the basement collection. And that's such a cool reality. I don't know. It was just cool that people felt that way. That's probably the best way to say that. And I was more than happy to accommodate because there were way more cards than I had a whole, you know, U-Haul full of them.
But I mean, even the way that you documented it, though, where it was like, you know, your guys are pulling out, like I see Chris from Missouri pulling out a box and opening up the lid and going, oh, look at this. It's a bunch of 75 tops or whatever. And then one of those 75 tops that Chris, I mean, it's like it was experiencing the whole thing from start to finish. And if this other deal goes through, I certainly hope that you would do the same sort of thing where you could do that whole experience. And then like we were saying, you know, you could say feature the name of the shop and talk a lot about, and it's not the basement collection. It's the, you know, dugout cards collection or whatever, you know, it's like, you know, it could be beneficial to everyone.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, man, we certainly covered a lot of stuff in this episode. I hope everybody followed along okay. And I'm with you. I'm, of course, now I'm obviously doing this on a much smaller scale. It's not like I'm getting rid of everything or anywhere close. I'm selling a sliver to try to get some bigger stuff. I obviously think I can. I've resolved it with my own in my own brain that it's okay to do this. And not only is it okay, I've gotten now where, wow, I kind of like doing this. I kind of like seeing if I can turn this box into a DeLong Gehrig. How cool would that be, you know? And box of stuff that I have plenty of, like it's all excess, into a DeLong Gehrig. So,
yeah, and I'm glad we're talking about this because that was one of the things I've been thinking as you've been going through the process of making the sale of these cards and listing them and stuff. Is part of me was going, I wonder how Mike's going to feel about this after. Like, is he going to go, oh, man, like, and after you sold the first few shipments go out, you're like, what am I doing? I don't think I'm doing the right thing. Like, I was kind of curious on where you were going to be with that. But I think that it sounds like you're okay with it, which I think hopefully gives other people out there who have been hoarding and not releasing some things back out to others that might want it more kind of permission to try it because other collectors have tried it and it wasn't as heart-wrenching as they thought.
Yeah. And I think you would agree. Like if it's your grandfather's baseball card that he passed down, don't sell that. Sell something that, you know, that you can get again, like you said, that you can acquire easily.
Well, just a quick story, and I mentioned this on my channel once before, but you know, my dad's got a great collection, and I told him the only card I really want from your collection, the only card that I would never ever sell, is my dad's mom passed away when my dad was in college, and his dad basically moved out, basically sold the house, basically left everything behind, and his cards were in there, and he never knew what happened to his cards. And we were at a card shop a couple of miles from where he grew up, and we're going through the cards in the shop, and he's going through these commons, this commons box, and he sees a card, and it looked like he'd seen a ghost, and he pulls it out, and he had written his name on it, and he's like this was my card, like this is my handwriting, this is my card, I know what happened to my cards, like this is one of them. And so he bought that card with his name Mike M on it. Right. And he still has it. And I'm like, that's the only card from your collection I have to have, and I will never sell. And it is literally a worthless card from, I think it's the 59 set. It might be the 60. I think it's the 59 set. So it's just, the story means so much more, you know? Yeah.
So sell the stuff that doesn't have a story like that attached to it, right?
And, exactly.
And at least, like me, you know, it took me a while to get there. I'm not saying it's overnight if you don't have that mentality, but I'm having a good time with it. And I've got some great stuff, and I'll keep all of you guys informed on where I land with this. It may be a big nothing burger and I get nothing out of it, but it'll be fun to take you guys on that journey if we can make this happen. So Greg, thanks so much for being on the show this week, and appreciate you. Appreciate your friendship. And
of course, I had a lot of fun as always. That was a great story, and I feel like I'm at Baskin Robbins looking for the little ticket where I can get in line for when the deal goes through, so I can get my crack at a few of those, because I know a few of those I'm gonna be calling you over.
Oh man, so. It's good stuff. So I hope I get it. But
cool.
All right, everybody. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. I will catch you guys next week for another episode, and keep collecting and selling.